This is Forces Radio.
This is BFBS.
Never in the field of human combat.
The Forces Network.
So much hope.
Celebrating.
By so many.
RAF 100.
100. To show you.
RAF 100. Wings over Cyprus.
The year is 1968. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is showing at the cinema. London Bridge has just been sold to an American for £1 million. Fuel set you back a whole 7p a litre. And this was in the UK charts.
Hearts gone astray. Deep in hurt when they go, I went away just when you need me so. You won't regret, I've come back begging you. Won't you forget, welcome love we once knew. Open up your eyes, then you realize, here I stand with my everlasting love. Need you by my side, girl, to be my bride. You'll never be denied, everlasting love. From the very start, open up your heart. Feel that you fall, everlasting love.
1968 also saw the Royal Air Force mark the 50th anniversary of its formation. To celebrate the occasion, our predecessors created radio documentaries following six of the squadrons that were based at RAF Akrotiri.
Wings over Cyprus. We present the history of No. 32 Squadron, Royal Air Force Akrotiri.
Of the squadrons featured in Wings Over Cyprus, three are still operational today. Now, in 2018, we're finding out where those squadrons are and how that compares to their early beginnings, as documented in our archives.
January 1916. At home, Lord Kitchener looked down from every bill hoarding, his piercing eye and pointing finger accentuating the legend below, England needs you. The newspapers carried endless lists of names of the dead and missing in France. The British landings at Gallipoli in the previous April had failed miserably, and at last the troops were evacuated. In lighter vein, the Keystone Cops gave relief to those days of tension with their hilarious antics on the silent screen, and Mademoiselle from Armentières was the song of the day.
And that was the month that 32 Squadron was formed. On the 12th of January, the surplus personnel left behind by No. 21 Squadron, together with an assortment of Vickers fighters and Henry Farmans, assembled at Netheravon. Under the command of Major Rees, a man who'd already seen service on the Western Front, the squadron was soon undergoing intensive training. The Farmans and Vickers fighters were replaced by the latest DH-2s and Vickers bullets, and by May, the squadron was trained and ready for action.
The squadron remain trained and ready for action today. But since their 1995 merge with the Queen's Flight, they're now 32, the Royal Squadron. Their function is Command Support Air Transport, or CSAT. But what they're transporting varies quite dramatically. From vital kit and equipment in an operational theatre, to senior government ministers, military commanders, or even royalty.
It's difficult because our mission is so varied, it would be great to be able to say we're going to do this in this month and this in this month. Actually, it's just continuing to be able to respond to some of the challenges we face. But it's just great to see how our people respond to those challenges, because to a man and woman on the squadron, people are always diving in and helping. And it's a very good example of teamwork in action every day.
That's 32, the Royal Squadron's executive officer, Squadron Leader Cy Reid. As well as a requirement for adaptable people to service their taskings, 32 operates some very clever aircraft. In addition to the Leonardo Grand New helicopter, exclusively operated out of RAF Northolt, is the BAE 146. In Kandahar in Afghanistan back in early 2014, they were part of the tactical air transport, moving personnel, kit and equipment around on Op Herrick. I was shown inside one of the Mark III models by crew captain Keith.
As you can see from here, the seat fit is half and half. This one's got 54 seats and the back end is a freight bay for all their armour and their kit. So what we've done is it's effectively half and half. Two-man flight deck, it's a nice aircraft, it's got four engines, so she's got relatively good performance for this theatre. In the tactical environment, the aircraft is fitted with self-defence type stuff. We have procedures which minimise the risk to the aircraft. This one's the grey jets, as you can see from the colour scheme outside. The jets back at Northolt, the white ones, it's termed as VIP. Within the VIP role, yes, we do move royalty, we move senior officers, heads of state, government ministers, and occasionally other ranks, but they have a very important job. So even though their rank might not entitle them to VIP status, their task does. However, VIP is not our primary task. The primary task of 32 Squadron is CSAT, the Command Support Air Transport. The VIP is secondary with any spare capacity. Operational support is pretty much our primary task, and everything else falls second to that.
When you consider the length of training needed by a pilot of today, the 4 months that those chaps got was remarkably short.
Well, yes, it was, but you must remember that in those days, a pilot had few refinements. A joystick, a compass, and a somewhat erratic RPM indicator. He either had a natural aptitude for flying, or he crashed. If you crashed often enough without killing yourself, you were sent back to your unit and routine soldiering. It would be an expensive way of sorting the wheat from the chaff these days, but in the main it seemed to work well enough then.
You said that the squadron was trained and ready for action by May. When in fact did they go to the front?
They flew out on the morning of the 28th of May. One of the pilots very nearly ended his days at the French coast. His engine seized on him just as he got over the cliffs, so he went round 180 degrees and into the nearest field. But he misjudged it and ran over the cliff. Miraculously, he made a second landing on the beach below without even a scratch. The rest of the squadron pressed on to Auchelle and started operational flying a few days later.
What was the role of the squadron at that time?
They worked with 25 Squadron, protecting reconnaissance aircraft. Occasionally, they had scraps with German aircraft, but in the main, the biggest problem was avoiding ground flak.
RAF 100. Wings over Cyprus. 32 Squadron.
Having moved away from the fighter role, the present-day squadron are unlikely to find themselves in a dogfight scrap. Instead, the challenges are often of a more diplomatic nature. For SAC Charlotte Oldshawn, it makes for interesting subject matter in her role as an admin clerk.
Yeah, so there are some news stories I do see, and I just think, oh, okay, this is going to be interesting over the next few days because we know that we will potentially be involved. I then consider, right, what areas are they going to? Are there areas where we might need to look at potential visas? Are there areas where they might need certain pilots to go? Or are there restrictions on female cabin crew? So there are those restrictions you have to consider as well. So it then goes to manning. However, I deal more with the visa side of things. So at the minute, we've got a visa currently going through, and I've had to go into London to go get those processed this morning. And then any taskings that require more thought processes, I leave that to the pilots. They're the experienced guys. They know exactly what they're doing. So it's down to them then just to tell me who's going so that I can make sure that we've got the correct paperwork for them so that they don't just turn up and then find they can't get into the country.
That's a lot of pressure and high stakes for someone who's not been in the Royal Air Force for very long. But Charlotte handles it admirably and is enjoying her career so far.
Because I've been in so little, there's still so much out there that I have yet to do. However, in the 2 years, I've managed to participate in the RAF Ski Champs, so going to Austria for a week. I've also participated in one of the RAF 100 events over in London, Liverpool Street, collecting for the RAF Benevolent Fund. and that involves some of our guys climbing the Gherkin about 50 times, which is the same distance as Mount Everest, I believe, so rather them than me. But there's loads of different things going on, and it's just having the opportunities to go for that. So I've managed to go on a few flights with the squadron as well. So I've been on the 109, I've been on the 146 over to Ramstein. So that was a nice little day trip out. I want to stay with 32 Squadron, gain the knowledge and the experience that is absolutely paramount to my career. So working on a squadron is sort of a specialism for my trade. I've learned what I needed to from PSF, but then I'm now specialising more towards pilots and cabin crew and working towards them, because they are completely different to other branches and trades that are on site.
Didn't 32 Squadron have a First War VC on the squadron at the time?
Yes, we did. That was Major Reese, the squadron commander. He got it for a particularly courageous action right at the beginning of the Somme offensive. He'd taken off with a Lieutenant Simpson to patrol the lines between La Bassée and Souchez. They ran into eight German...
We came out of the cloud, and before we knew it, the sky seemed to be full of Albatross two-seaters. I broke away from Simpson and went after one to the right. I got in a few shots before I lost him in the cloud. When I cleared the cloud, there was no sign of Simpson or the other German aircraft, so I continued my patrol. A few minutes later, I encountered the Albatrosses again. I fired on the leading aircraft and saw pieces of the fuselage break away between the pilot and the observer. He dived away. I banked round and immediately saw another. As I attacked, he fired off some reds and three other aircraft came to help him, dive him from above. Fortunately for me, they were going fast and they overshot me. I fired a few more rounds and this time got his engine, and he went down to the lines in a blue haze, but seemingly well under control. Almost at once, I saw five more all bunched together, so I just fired into the middle of them. They scattered at once, the leader and the two others heading west. I went after them, and being a good deal faster than they, quickly came into range. One of them opened up to hit me in the leg, but I was able to maintain control and got in a good long burst, which I maintained until I broke off 10 yards away from him.
And this amazing man then tried to finish it off with his pistol, but he caught his hand on the lip of the cockpit and knocked his pistol to the floor. He gave the leader a last burst as they went over the trenches and then flew back to base and into hospital. I think he well deserved the Victoria Cross he was awarded a couple of months later.
RAF 100. Wings over Cyprus. 32 Squadron.
That rich history of the squadron is not only documented in our archives from 1968, but also forms the memorabilia kept on the squadron at RAF Northolt, which the likes of Squadron XO Psy are inspired by each and every day.
There's tons. It's difficult to put a finger on one thing. You walk in the squadron, you see some of the heritage of the squadron in terms of the medals that have been won when we were a fighter squadron in World War II. And you just see the way the squadron's grown up. And you see all those little bits of bric-a-brac, really, that get collected from World War II onwards, things that come from the Gulf War, things that bring the squadron to life when you look at the different aircraft types we've operated and places we've been, particularly when you think about the roles that we've gone through. So be it starting as a fighter squadron in World War One, working through to light bombers, then communications, and the role we find ourselves in now as a CSAT squadron.
Performing command support air transport has kept the squadron at the forefront of more recent operations too. On Op Herrick in Afghanistan, their BAE 146 fleet were kept busy working alongside the C-130 Hercules, providing tactical air transport.
I don't know whether you know much about the 146. We've got four aircraft on the fleet. We've got two 100 variants, which we call the Mark II in the Air Force. This is the Mark III. The Mark II is white. That's sort of our VVIP role. And then the Mark III painted grey. See this with five windows that were here, that's actually a freight door. That's a major difference. And what this does is allows us to change the configuration inside. So we can go from an entire seat fit, from half and half, which you saw inside. So we've got 54 seats, and then we've got the baggage bins at the back. Or we can take all that out and have what we call igloos, which are essentially small ISO containers you just stick in the back. So it's a completely freight aircraft.
I know from the other squadron's histories that we've covered that there were frequent changes of aircraft, of command, of airfield, and presumably this was the case with 32.
Yes, it was. Command changed often because casualties were high and the experienced commanders were quickly promoted. During the war, the squadron changed from DH-2 aircraft to DH-5s and finished up with SE-5s. Like the other squadrons, 32 moved around a good deal and varied their escort duties with ground strafing of troop columns and artillery batteries. One interesting point is that even in those days, there were exchange postings between countries. We, for instance, had a United States Air Force serving officer attached to us in 1918. Unfortunately, he got shot down just before the end of the war.
Yes, that's one thing that hasn't come out in the squadron histories, the American involvement. Looking at Air Commodore Payne's book on dates of note in aviation, I saw that during the war, the Americans had 45 squadrons in France with a complement of 740 aeroplanes. Now, I know that seems a lot, but quite insignificant against the, I think it was 22,647 aeroplanes that we had.
Well, that state of affairs didn't last long. As soon as the war ended, there was an immediate rundown. Of the 188 squadrons at the end of the war, only 25 remained in 1920. 32 Squadron, like so many others, was reduced to a nucleus and went back to England in 1919.
How long was it then before they brought the squadron back out of retirement?
Not until July 1923, though we weren't fully up to strength until 1924.
Was this as a result of that famous memorandum by Trenchard, which gave the first guidelines for the service?
Well, indirectly, I suppose it was. Trenchard recommended that squadrons overseas should be kept to a minimum and that the somewhat meagre sum of money voted annually to the RAF should be used for the perfecting of training. This followed by the Salisbury inquiry in 1923 into the air strength that Britain needed led to the resurrection of many squadrons.
And what was the role of the squadron in those days?
Essentially a fighter one. 32 were equipped with snipes and, in addition to routine training, did an awful lot of display work. In 1924, they put on displays at the Wembley Exhibition, in 1925 at the Aldershot Tattoo and the famous Hendon Air Display. In 1926, however, the squadron got a rather unusual job due to the general strike.
What was that?
They transported mail and dispatches about the country, often in appalling weather conditions. Well, you know the old maxim, the mail must get through.
That period between the wars is often referred to as the flying club or salad days of the Royal Air Force.
Yes, I think that between the wars, flying was a fairly light-hearted occupation. But nevertheless, looking back through old squadron exercise records, they did extremely well. At Sutton Bridge, for instance, in 1930, during an exercise, they managed an average of 40 flying hours a day, and one chap managed to put 78% of his shots on target during air-to-ground firing. I mean, this is good by any standards.
Wasn't 32 Squadron the first squadron to do radar-controlled attacks?
Well, not attacks. In 1938, one of the squadron's aircraft did a radar interception on a Dutch airliner over the Thames, and I believe that was the first on record.
Forces Radio.
BFBS. RAF 100. Wings over Cyprus. Wings over
Cyprus. While operations are still the primary focus of 32 Squadron in 2018, it's the royal element of their name that's particularly fascinating. They're tasked to move some of the world's most influential people, including senior members of the royal family. The image that comes to my mind is of 25-year-old Queen Elizabeth II walking down the steps of an aircraft, having learned of her father's passing and flown immediately from a tour of Kenya. If you're to believe the series The Crown, she did so having had to change quickly into mourning clothes in the back of that aircraft that she'd just arrived on. It's flight taskings like this that could fall to the crews of 32, the Royal Squadron, and it demands the utmost discretion.
Yeah, do you know something? This job is really difficult because we are incredibly privileged with the proximity that we have with some of our VVIP passengers. And whilst it would be interesting and sort of almost Daily Mail worthy of some of the stories we can tell, it's very difficult. My major experience of our passengers is that the nicest thing we get is when they remind us that what we've done has made a difference to their day or the event that they were participating in. So to be able to pick them up and drop them off somewhere, the expediency, the fact that we've provided them with a safe space to prepare themselves and then they can land and do what politicians and what senior officers do is the nicest thing. And I think it always makes your day when you have the Prime Minister thank you for what you've done.
A formal thank you for their services came back in 2015, when shortly before they marked their centenary, they were awarded a new standard.
The new standard bears the battle honours of 32 Squadron, displaying their victories at the Somme, during the Battle of Britain, and in the First Gulf War. standards are regarded as a symbol of the spirit of the fighting unit, reflecting their gallant deeds.
For the squadron, it really reflects two things. It reinvigorates the trust between the sovereign and the squadron, but actually for us it's also a shrine. So a shrine for the activities that have been completed over the last 99 years for the squadron, and most notably, celebrations of the Battle of Britain.
Well, I think that just about brings us up to the Second World War. What were the squadron highlights during that period?
Unfortunately, many of the squadron records have been destroyed, but from what we have, it would seem that Dunkirk was the main milestone, or rather the first one. During that time, the squadron destroyed 17 aircraft plus 9 probables. Then, of course, came the Battle of Britain, and between July and October of 1940, a total of 49 aircraft were destroyed by the squadron, plus 25 probables and 14 damaged. From there, the squadron's Hurricanes went on to convoy patrols and were, in fact, involved in the Scharnhorst and Neisenau attack in 1942. Then came Dieppe and ground strafing in support of the army.
I'd always thought that 32 were very much an overseas squadron. Weren't they involved in the desert war at all?
Only at the tail end. We joined the war in Algeria in December of 1942 and added a number of kills to our score. Then we followed up the invasion of Italy and were based at Foggia and engaged in shipping strikes. By this time, the squadron had Spitfires, which were kept right up until 1948.
Oh, you stayed in Italy till the end of hostilities then?
No, we had another move towards the end of 1944, this time down to Greece, but only for 3 or 4 months before we moved down to Ramat David in Palestine.
What did the squadron do in Palestine?
Well, initially, anti-terrorist patrols of the oil pipelines, and then later, searches for ships bringing in illegal immigrants. They had a great deal of success in this role, largely due to the information received from the radar station on top of Mount Carmel. It's interesting that another squadron at Ramat David at this time was No. 6 Squadron, who are, of course, a brother squadron here at Akrotiri.
Was there anything of note that happened to the squadron after that, in that period?
Well, things were fairly calm then for a while, and it wasn't until 1948 that anything of note appears in the diary. Just as the squadron were preparing to move to Nicosia, Egyptian aircraft made a couple of attacks on the airfield, injured two of the squadron airmen, and destroyed a Dakota in which all the ground crew's kit had been stowed. I suppose it's some consolation that all the attacking aircraft were destroyed, but the ground crews were more than a little upset at losing so many of their personal possessions.
Deployment nowadays is slightly different. We don't have the risk of our Dakota being blown up, but even so, we still end up going to Kabul, we still end up going to areas where significant threat exists. Kit-wise, I just think about it from point of view as being the squadron exo, that if guys had their kit blown up, I know they'd be in my office the next day asking how do they claim, and the fact that they'd lost their vital iPad and they'd lost all their electronic devices. That's the sort of change nowadays of when people go away, they go with their big electronic footprint. I suppose it's changing generations, really.
RAF 100. Forces Radio.
BFBS.
BFBS. Wings over Cyprus.
When you moved to Nicosia, I believe you became the first squadron in the Middle East to get jet aircraft. Is that right?
Yes, that's so. You've obviously been doing your homework. We were re-equipped with Venoms.
And did the squadron's role change with the new aircraft?
The role as such didn't change, but of course there were no conflicts in the area then, and the squadron's effort went into training. This was broken up by some rather nice trips over to Turkey for an aerobatic display, a proving flight down to South Africa, and so on.
And presumably the squadron's been in Cyprus ever since?
No, in 1951 it moved over to Chalufa in the Canal Zone, and then in January of 52 on to Devassoir. Later that year, another move over the Bitter Lake to Cabrit. The 32 was static then until 1955, and then several quick moves to Shaiba, Takali, Jordan, and finally back to Nicosia in 57 when the Canberras came to us.
Well, conversion from fighters to bombers is quite a step. Presumably this wasn't done at Nicosia.
Oh no, although the squadron was still 32 Squadron, it was a complete change of aircrews who'd trained and formed up at Western Zoyland.
All of the squadrons at Akrotiri have squadron standards. When did 32 get theirs?
That too happened in 57. Air Chief Marshal Sir James Robb made the presentation here at Akrotiri in June of that year.
Now, am I right this time when I suggest that 32 Squadron have been in Cyprus ever since they got their cameras?
Half right. We've been based here since then, but detachments have taken the squadron all over the place. Sharjah, Peshawar, Nairobi, in connection with NATO and CENTO exercises, and then in more recent times out to the Far East during the confrontation.
Detachments in 2018 continue to take the crews all over the place, as Loadmaster Charlie will testify.
It's massively mixed. It depends on aircraft serviceability. If we've got no-notice tasks that come up, or we've got long operational tasks that have been in the pipeline for a while. The places we've gone and go compared to other fleets makes it unique. I get to enjoy places that my peers on other fleets might not get to. I've been as close as Biggin Hill, just down the road, and as far as Bangkok in Thailand. So Europe, Africa, operational theatres, Far East. It's not forever. I do enjoy it, but I'll be ready for moving on to a different platform in the near future.
BFBS. RAF 100. Wings over Cyprus. 32 Squadron.
We undertook this project knowing it would be fascinating to find out where 32 the Royal Squadron are today compared to 50 years ago when our colleagues documented their histories. Back in 1968, the officer commanding made some predictions as to the future of 32, and we thought it was only fitting to ask the current squadron members what they made of those predictions and to make some of their own.
Well, from early DH2 days right up until now, the squadron has been largely involved in ground attack work. Your Canberras are getting rather old now and obviously will soon have to be replaced. So, what of the future for 32?
This is yet to be resolved, but I sincerely hope that 32 Squadron's links with the Middle East will long be retained.
Wow.
He sounds posher than me. They have quite a different role to what we have today. The squadron's evolved quite a lot.
So, obviously, we're no longer based in Cyprus, which I think is a little bit of a shame because I'd like to be in the nice sunshine right now. But I do think we still have good ties with other countries, especially Middle Eastern countries. We do still continue to do that support, although we're not ground attack now. We're more supporting our government and doing VIP tasking. So we've changed our role slightly, but we're still there for our country and our government to help with maintaining those diplomatic ties.
Wings Over Cyprus was written and narrated by Arthur Stagg and produced by Kathy Emmett in the Episcopi Studios.
With special thanks to Amy Casey for conducting interviews at RAF Northolt. RAF 100 Wings Over Cyprus with 32 the Royal Squadron was written and produced by me, Jade Calloway, at Forces Radio BFBS in RAF Akrotiri.